I'd like to take a moment to introduce our final speaker of the evening, Dr. James Austin. Dr. Austin is a neurologist, an award-winning author, researcher, and Zen practitioner who has dedicated himself to 6 decades of brain research. He is a professor emeritus of neurology at the University of Colorado, Health Sciences Center, and courtesy professor of neurology at the University of Florida's College of Medicine. Today, Dr. James Austin will be giving us a guest lecture on recent reflections on Zen and the brain. Please join me in welcoming him.
First, let me thank Pial and Indy Waltola for the kind invitation to attend this conference. I'm here, as you can hear, as a neurologist, and I haven't seen many Zen or Chan monks at this conference yet, and so I thought I'd bring along another panelist to share in the discussions. If there are any questions I can't answer, I will refer to to Bodhidharma. Well, I started in Kyoto 43 years ago, and my attempts since then to keep up with Zen and with the way the brain functions has been a quest really for self-information. And since Zen meditation in particular is very focused on the training of attention and on the training of awareness, let's start with the first slide. This doesn't seem to be operating yet, but I'm sure we have a therapy. Well, we see the two hemispheres, and they do differ in their functional capacities. You're looking down on the right hemisphere, off to your right. And you're looking at the left hemisphere, which is certainly equipped for more of a fine grain kind of processing of the outside world. And moreover, since you're in a neurological mode, you're looking at a left hemisphere that is processing visual information off to the left, off to the right. So neurology is crossed. And you're looking at the right hemisphere, thank you. You're looking at the right hemisphere that is more of a coarse grain kind of processing. And what it receives off here allows more room for kind of atmospheres of aesthetic appreciation and for the kinds of processing that interpret values and meaning into what it sees. And whereas the left hemisphere for most people is the language hemisphere, the right hemisphere in pretty much the same regions attends and helps process events in both sides of the environment. So this is where our spatial attention comes from, and it comes because it sends over pathways through the corpus callosum and co-opts what the left hemisphere says and concludes that I'll take care of both sides of the environment reflexly. We like to think that we only have one reality, but instead we actually have two realities, only one of which are we conscious of. The egocentric, self-centered, self-referential kind of processing looks out at this apple, and its lines of sight are all directed back through to this subject, who views it through the subjective lens of the person and takes it as something that is close and reachable and is egocentric. Ego, an old Greek word. The second kind of reality relates to the word allo, the corresponding contrast, the old Greek word, and it means other. So when processing goes on out here in the outside world, this apple is related to this apple, and this apple to this apple. And none of that is directly attributable to the subject back here. The perception will cross out this person temporarily. The perception is more objective. Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher many years ago, called this kind of processing the thing in itself. The apples out here in themselves, the Ding on Sich, with nobody back here doing it. It might help to get your mind around this by thinking that instead of the first egocentric processing, what's happening here is that somebody else is taking a picture through the lens of somebody else's camera. And all of this registration is going on without our being aware that it is actually taking place. Now, what I'd like you to do by way of invitation, and you can do this or not as you please, but I'd like you to close your eyes in a few seconds, and when I say open, open them and direct your focused vision only on this white cross in the center of the screen. Is everybody ready for this experiment? Okay. So close. Now open and look right at this white spot. Now look at this white spot. Did anybody see anything interesting? I hope you all saw a flag from your neighbor to the south. If so, this is just a demonstration by way of reminding you that a lot goes on globally, when you're focusing your attention on a small spot in the center of your environment. And since this is a global conference, this is designed to reinforce your inclusive notion that everything that goes on in the periphery will sooner or later impact your lives. For better or for worse. To follow up on the previous slides, let's look at this brain down here. The nose is here, the seeing part of the brain back here in the occipital lobe. And you're seeing the intraparietal sulcus in the frontal eye field and the inferior frontal gyrus and the temporal parietal junction right here. And you're seeing the egocentric self-centered representation pathway following a northern route here in the dorsal part of the brain. And in contrast, a lot of the allocentric processing is following a more ventral pathway through the brain. Along the way, it runs through the fusiform gyrus, which happens to be one of the answers to the lady who was asking the question about why do I see colors when I meditate. The colors are seen pretty much in the fourth visual area here. They're a second wave of processing. And they are the color, that's the region responsible for the red, white, and blue colors that you saw on the flag as a visual after image. So as this brain looks out into the outside world, you'll notice that the red colors more in the dorsal region are related more to the objects in the ventral or lower part of the visual field. And so this is a reminder that touch and proprioception are very much a function attributable to our frontal and our parietal lobes, respectively. And so, ladies, if you are sitting down and have a young baby on your lap, you're relying on your parietal lobe for touch and proprioception so that the babe doesn't fall off. And gents, when you're trying to attach a nail to the wall to hang a picture on using a hammer, you have to have a very keen sense of ability to hand-eye coordinate your hammering functions, or otherwise your fingers are history. So touch and proprioception are crucial along the whole northern route. But what about if you've got a saber-toothed tiger 100 yards away from you in your ancestral paths? What about that? Here you need to be able to process and identify an object that's out there, and you're asking the what question. You're asking, what is it out there, and what does it mean? That's different from the question the northern pathway asks. It asks the question, where? Or better still, where is it in relation to me so that I can reach it with my tactile sensibilities and manipulate it? Objects out here, we hope, in the case of the tiger, are going to be intangible. If you can feel a tiger, you won't enter the gene pool. And if you recover from that episode, having identified the tiger, you can look out again with your lower ventral pathways into the world outside and breathe thankfully that you've escaped the situation. So the reminder is that you're looking down at a point usually in front of you when you're using your dorsal and more egocentric pathways. Whereas you're looking above your visual horizon at events going on up here when you're using your lower allocentric pathways. One of the main reasons that I enjoy showing you this Bodhidharma is that the actual position of Bodhidharma's eyes are often shown in art, as being directed upward. And those of you, I think, who are in the front row may be able to make out, or will be if I hand this out, to verify that Bodhidharma is shown looking up in his meditative practices. One of the reasons you can see his eyes so well is that he led in as legendary caution, found that falling asleep was often related to the fact that he was closing his eyes when he was meditating. So this is a reminder to Zen meditators to keep your eyes at least at half-mast position to stay awake. This is a slide from a classical article published about 2005 or so from Washington University in St. Louis. Michael Fox and Mark Rakel co-authored this paper. And we're looking here at a functional MRI slide of the left hemisphere. You notice the left hemisphere because the nose will be about here. And the visual cortex back here, the nose here, visual cortex back here. Again, the left hemisphere because you're looking at the inner or medial aspect of the brain. And you're seeing some colors that tell you that these are hot spots and that the blue areas are cold spots. And in this slide, the IPS and the other blue areas are identifying the dorsal attention system. And the yellow and reddish areas are demonstrating regions commonly included in what is known as the default network, which includes the medial prefrontal cortex, the posterior cingulate cortex, in the same area as the precuneus, and the retrosplenial cortex, which has an interesting connection with the parahippocampus. And over here is the angular gyrus, which is the third of the frontal parietal regions that are concerned in generating our sense of an autobiographical self. So if you're looking for something corresponding to the psychic sense of self, to the sense of self that knows where it was when it grew up in its earlier bedroom, the sense of self who is an ongoing agency because it can lay down a topographical idea along with where it was as a physical body at the time. So this is pretty much what has come to be thought of as the autobiographical and topographical sense of self, or the area where we perform our self-othering kinds of linked functions and representations. And you might be aware that this bottom part of the slide occupies an extent of 5 minutes. And so during this 5-minute period, all of the ups and downs of these two general areas, both attention on the one hand and self-other representations on the other hand, that these are going in an up and down direction like a seesaw. If the self-generating regions are going up, the attentive regions are going down. And when the attentive regions are turned on, the self-generating regions are going to be deactivated. This is of profound importance to all kinds of meditators, because the bottom line message is that when you're training your attention, at the same time you're turning down some of the representations of self. And one of the key things that we're attempting to do when we meditate is to let things develop that cut down on the overactive, overconditioned sense of self. So you can verify this to see that about three times every minute, there's a reversal in this spontaneous, intrinsic, slow rhythm of the brain, the exact cause of which has not yet been determined by neuroscience. But the other fascinating thing is that if you create a sudden sound, for example, the sound of a crow that managed to be the triggering stimulus for Master Ikkyu, if a sudden sound comes in, it will attract and capture attention, which will turn on the attention areas of the brain, and at the same time, it will turn down the self other regions of the brain. So here, by way of a visual representation, is what I've been demonstrating. When external attention is turned on and captured, the sense of self and the representations of self are deactivated, and vice versa. So suppose you're a meditator and you've been training for a number of years. You're at a retreat. All of your sensibilities are heightened, and your up and down seesaw orientations between your egocentric processing and your attention and allocentric processing are undergoing this inverse relationship. And all of a sudden, there is an external triggering stimulus. In Zen lore, quite commonly, the triggering stimulus is a bird call or the flight of a bird. And this triggering stimulus happens to come in from the outside at a very propitious, selective moment. It comes in when the egocentric modes are just about ready to turn down, and right at the time when the allocentric processing modes are right about to turn up. So the result is an overshoot. A major overshooting of a reflexive capacity of the brain, in the course of which allocentric referential processing is enhanced and egocentric self-referential processing is markedly inhibited for an unknown and unidentifiable period of time. Why no longer a sense of time? Because this is a timeless moment, a state when self drops out, when time drops out, when perfection pervades the global impression that the brain is registering. And this is a moment that is called, at least in the Zen tradition, Kensho or Satori. So we're in the presence of an explanation for those not so much spontaneous moments, but triggered moments that can precipitate a moment of awakening. What is this moment like? Well, another visual attempt to describe it would start up at the top here with our usual sense of self being magnified or hyperactive or inflated. And along a parallel pathway would be what we think about the other world outside us. Self being markedly dominant, other people and other things occupying much less of our attention. With only a few pores, P-O-R-E-S, here representing our ability to appreciate the world outside us. But then, in a moment of non-duality, the allocentric world takes over and occupies the entire mental field. And afterwards, as the moment proceeds on, afterwards, the sense of self that otherwise used to be so large is now smaller and more porous and has a more ready appreciation of other and of the outside world. So this would be a visual metaphor for the sense of awakening. So how is this possible? Well, it's not possible unless there is some, and we postulate some more central region of the brain that is in a central position to exert its influence on both hemispheres simultaneously. So here we're looking for the first time. You may have heard the word thalamus at this conference. We're looking at the left thalamus and its relationships to the left cerebral hemisphere. What do all these lines mean? These lines refer to the markedly fast hyper-oscillations that oscillate between the thalamus and the cortex. They're faster than a hummingbird's wing, 70, 100 times per second or so. These are not your usual slow alpha, theta, or beta waves. These are fast oscillations. And notice that in the dorsal part of the thalamus, the three most anterior nuclei of the thalamus are all called the limbic nuclei. Why call them limbic? Because they have extensive interactions with the limbic system, and because they're in a position to relay all of these up to the cerebral cortex. Ever since you've entered this amphitheater, all of your sensory processing, with the exception of smell, have likewise passed through your thalamus on your way up to cortex. And here we see the pivotal position of the dorsal part of the thalamus. Moreover, the dorsal pulvinar is in a position not only to interact with the medial part of the posterior medial parietal cortex, but it's in a position also to interact with the angular gyrus on the outside of the cortex. And here, the lateral dorsal nucleus is in a position to go into the retrospinal cortex. And we're reminded that the lateral posterior nucleus is the nucleus that is associated with the superior parietal lobule, the lobule that conveys our sense of a schema to our body and takes our arm on the one side, our arm on the other side, our leg, our head, and trunk, and fuses them into a workable image that we can accomplish things with. So this dorsal thalamus, then, is in a marked position to turn on or turn off key areas of the lateral and of the medial cortex. But how is that possible? It's possible because the thalamus has a shield, a cap, that fits nicely, especially over its dorsal portions. A GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid, negative inhibitory cap, which can disrupt the orderly to and fro oscillations that flow back and forth between thalamus and cortex. I'm holding in my hand a set of Bose noise-canceling earphones. The next time you see a pair of these, try them on. Listen to music that has some static or is obscured by a low rumble, and see for yourself how simply turning on a little switch that occupies a very small AAA battery can, by canceling up the unwanted tones, allow all the music to come through and to shut out the other resonances that you don't want to hear. So if you're looking for a model for Kensho, keep in mind the dorsal tier of the thalamus for when it's inhibited by the reticular nucleus. It would simultaneously be capable of inhibiting the medial prefrontal, the medial posterior parietal cortex, and the angular gyrus, and the superior parietal lobule, thus inhibiting in one stroke the psychic sense of self and its connections with the emotional overtures of the overactive limbic system that is such a cause of our deep suffering. On the other hand, the more ventral, allocentric, other referential pathway is relatively spared and more relatively able to proceed in an augmented fashion and perceive the other world out there more or less with a sense of things as they really are. Thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to have any questions.
Any questions at all for Dr. Austin?
It's late in the day, but you've already had a session of meditation, which should keep you awake.
I think we've got one right over there.
Thank you, Doctor, for the very careful and detailed connection, neural connection to explain Kensho moment. Is that the same like Kwan? I'm familiar with Kwan moment. the moment of awakening in Zen meditation from China and from Vietnam. Yes. Is it the same at Kensho?
That would be corresponding, yes.
Yes. So when you have that moment, how do you expand that moment? So 24 hours over 24 that you have on awakening.
Is your question, how do you fall in and fall out of it?
Well, I was instructed by my teacher that meditation or mindfulness is not during walking or sitting, but 24 over 24, including the time you are sleeping.
Yes.
So when this moment that you explained, when the self concept or the self disappears?
Usually during waking.
Yes.
And what I've tried to put out as a model for Kensho are the gross connections that we're aware of in the brain that would enable a deep central part of the brain to both inhibit the sense of self and to open up a more global perspective on the outside world to reveal things as they really are in their suchness, at the same time that there is anatta and shunyata, no sense of self back in the center doing it.
Yes, I understand.
So that would be the tentative model
I see.
That I hope neuroscience will wrestle with this and come up with some better explanations than mine at the moment.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
Thank you, Dr. Austin, for that presentation. I found it very enlightening to see some empirical, presentations of how meditation can affect brain chemistry and the physicality of the brain. And I hope I understood and read your slides correctly for obvious reasons. But just wondering, I find it really fascinating that particular moment of non-duality. During that period of meditation, between the alo and ego, and I'm wondering, maybe I'm just trying to draw a philosophical connection to that particular moment of non-duality. I'm wondering, is that where you would say the experience of compassion or metta or loving kindness would be experienced?
Nothing that I've pointed out directly addresses the most important word that you've uttered, which is compassion, except for the fact that as Thich Nhat Hanh reminded us many times long ago, that it's crucial to drop out one's subjective anger, hate, and all of the negative emotions in order to allow the positive and more affirmative emotions to emerge. So I would say that any explanation that we might develop neurophysiologically that helps us submerge the overconditioned limbic sources of self will at the same time allow the other referential, more affirmative, more global parts of the brain to exert their influence on what they perceive. What's tricky is the fact that the brain at one and the same moment is becoming more open and more inclusive of everything out there, of the things that they really are, the impression that this is the real reality now. It's only capable of doing that when the sense of self drops out. And it's very hard to imagine, but it's easier to relate to it when that episode has taken over your own brain for several minutes. Several hours, or several days. That's about all I can say on that topic. Thank you for your question.
May I ask a follow-up question? Is that okay with the moderator?
Well, that's up to our moderator.
We have 7 minutes,
so,
sir. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm just curious to know also with the image that you showed with the up and down and of the left and right brain activity. I'm just wondering too, was that study done on those with extensive experience in meditation? Like, how experienced were those individuals who were being studied too?
Were you talking about the color slide that was originally described by Michael Fox?
It was from a study done in 2007, I believe, 2005, 2007.
Was that? I'm sorry, I'm not sure what your slide you're talking about. Can
it's
you
the,
clarify
the same
that?
Slide where the point of non-duality you showed, where the allo and ego were sort of outside of time.
Well, all I can say is that the functional MRI slide was done on normal people and studied for 5 minutes. And if your question relates to, has functional MRI been done on someone who was dropping into Kensho, the answer is not yet.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask if you're familiar with the British psychiatrist's work, Ian McGilchrist, and his thesis about left and right lateralization.
Go ahead.
I came across it, within the last year, and I've found it really fascinating, and I was wondering if you were familiar with it, if you could comment. But he explains that the right hemisphere seeks to know things in context.
Yes.
And is more willing to sort of step back and say, I don't know it all yet. Mm-hmm. Whereas the left hemisphere, which is it's really interesting, but is where, we're predisposed to want to grasp something, categorize it, put it in its, its proper place. And his thesis is that we've shaped Western culture over the last several thousand years more in line with those left hemispheric values, mm-hmm. and it's hurting us.
That general notion is what I was attempting to show with the more fine-grained lateralization, lateralized to the left hemisphere, and the right hemisphere perception showing a greater space within which to be more flexible.
Right.
Less rigid and less captured by the moment. As you may know, this lateralization of function was a Nobel Prize winning topic when it first came out. And it's been beat and beat by a large number of people in both directions with some degree of controversy over the years.
Right.
But I think it's fair to say that the two hemispheres are markedly different. And what I'd like to emphasize is that the right hemisphere entered into a bargain years ago, billions of years ago, with our left hemisphere, in which the two decided that mostly language would be on the left side,
mm-hmm.
and our attentive focusing particularly to both sides of the environment, and particularly out there, and particularly above the visual horizon, not down here where we usually focus our meditation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is where we should be looking.
Yeah.
Not down next to ourselves, which is within our grasp, but out there in the big wide
right.
of Mother Nature, trees.
And more inclined toward unity consciousness.
Our natural world that we grew up in evolutionarily.
Yeah.
We didn't grow up sitting on a cushion.
Yeah.
We didn't evolve sitting on a cushion indoors.
Yeah. Well, his thesis is so fascinating that I'd really like more people to kind of think about how we have sort of allowed those values of wanting to, you know, put things in categories and grasp and so on, that we've shaped our culture to the point where the right hemisphere has, like, you know, less and less of a voice or a place in modern culture. And it's probably why we are in, you know, a lot of the messes we are.
Well,
yeah,
we're certainly there.
Yeah. Okay, thank you for your
Thank you. And once again, thank you so much, Dr. Austin, for your talk.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.